Good afternoon. Today we'll open a. Today is what is today? May 11th, 2017. We're opening a our subcommittee on public safety. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 5005 on the Criminal Justice Commission. And I do have to point out, if you see this young buck in the back over there in the corner, that would be Nick Stark, my nephew. And if you see him nodding off, I warned him about Mike's presentations. So just give him candy. No, I'm just teasing. Oh, I'm teasing, Mike. You're fantastic.
Brutal. I want to know what happened to Mr. Schmidt's beard. Yes. I miss it. Yes. Wow.
Baby snuggles. Yes. So, no, anyway, Mike's fantastic, and I love the data that you give us, Mr. Schmidt. But before you do, Julie, is there any sort of review or anything that you desire to share before we get going with our presentation?
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members. No, actually, we'll just cut right to Mike. The tree has been moved.
Which?
Oh, it has. Look at that.
I have good video. If you miss the trees being moved, we have video.
I do, too.
So
I think everybody does.
Fourth floor.
It was great. I just watched it.
Hey, we've tried. So on that note, after you explain or tell us how your baby is doing, why don't you, then you can start your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and my baby is officially 4 months old as of yesterday. He weighs in at 19 pounds and 9 ounces.
Whoa.
All right. He is 29 and 3/4 inches long. That is the average size of a one-year-old.
Exactly how big my one-year-old was.
So he's huge. He's healthy. He's happy. He's the four-month fit, you know, stage. He's getting into giggling back and forth, you know, so we're having a lot of fun with that, and he thinks everything we do is funny, and so we think everything he does is funny. So it's pretty fantastic. Thank you for asking.
Excellent.
Nice.
So I will launch into our phase two presentation. I have broken it into four topic areas. The first will be justice reinvestment. We've done a lot on justice reinvestment in this committee, but I wanted to just give you a few updates and touch on some of the more current issues, particularly around the rising numbers of women in prison. And then we will move on to specialty courts. I received questions from committee staff on specialty courts. And so I'm prepared to talk about a little bit more in depth. And I've asked the district attorney from Washington County, DA Bob Herman, to be here to kind of give you more of a county level perspective of how the courts work, since a lot of the questions were more around the kind of nuts and bolts. From there, we will talk about our federal Burn JAG grant, which is a grant that the CJC, it's a formula grant from the federal government that we apply for and receive pretty regularly. And for that, I have asked District Attorney Rod Underhill from Multnomah County to be present, as Multnomah County and particularly his office has worked with our commission and has been the recipient of a couple of our Burn JAG awards. So to let the let you all know kind of how that works. And then furthermore, I've also gotten Kelly Minty Morris, commissioner from Klamath County, and also Mike MacArthur, the executive director of AOC, here to talk about another Burn JAG grant that we have given out, our LIPSIC coordinator grant. And then finally, I just wrap up with the pending legislation that is in front of you all in Ways and Means, but that impacts the CJC, and happy to answer any questions on that.
And I want to say to all those individuals who are here to testify, thank you for coming back. Again, my apologies for the House floor scheduling that caused us to cancel at the last minute previously when everybody had come once before, and here you are again. So thank you for making a second trip.
All right, so justice reinvestment. This will very briefly wanted to give you all a sense of the timeline that we're working under. In fact, yesterday, the staff of the CJC released the request for proposals to the counties. So we have already begun the process of soliciting applications from the counties. Obviously, at this point, we don't know what the final dollar amount will be that the counties are applying for. But nevertheless, we are getting out the process for them to apply for those funds. We intend to begin accepting applications in July. We statutorily have a grant review committee that looks just at these applications. And so that committee will begin meeting and reviewing those RFPs in August, as well as a victim advisory panel that we have constituted to help us with the victim community piece. And then from there, recommendations will be made to our commissioners in September, and we will be awarding those grants upon recommendations of our commission and get that money out as early as November is what we're shooting for. So that's just kind of a timeline of our process. The process this time around is going to be a little bit different than we've done it in the past, and I just want to show you what we have created, and we're beginning the process of showing this to the counties. This is a kind of a high-level dashboard overview for the counties to work off when they're writing their justice reinvestment applications to the commission. And so this is on our website, and we are encouraging all applicants to refer back to this over and over again. And it really links to the goals of justice reinvestment, which is to reduce recidivism, to decrease prison usage, to increase public safety and holding offenders accountable. So what a county will do with this resource as they're writing their applications, I'll choose Marion County here as it reloads. So Marion County, if you're writing a justice reinvestment grant for Marion County, you'll go onto the website and immediately you'll be able to see your recidivism rates compared to the statewide recidivism rates. The three lines represent arrests, conviction, and then incarceration rates. So immediately Marion County can see how they stack up to the state. Obviously they could click on any other county. And then what we encourage them to write in their application is how their justice reinvestment grants address their specific recidivism rates, how it is that they believe that these funds will be used to help decrease those rates. So they'll be reacting to real-time live data as to how their county recidivism rates actually are performing against the state. And we also allow them to toggle between 1 year and 3 year rates, just because justice reinvestment, the program has been around essentially for a little over 3 years, so we're just getting those recidivism numbers in. So you can see Marion County's 1 year rates, they've seen a drop in the last year, at least in the arrest, and a little tick up in conviction. So again, we're having them incorporate real data into how they're doing into our application so that they can react to the numbers that they're seeing. Then if you scroll down, they are looking at their prison usage. And you can see in Marion County, the red line represents a 10% increase of prison usage from before justice reinvestment existing. The gray line is essentially exactly how much prison they were using before justice reinvestment. And the jagged line that goes up and down there is how much prison did you use? And so you can see for Marion County, this goes back to 2013 and 14, right when justice reinvestment started. So they were using about the same. Then they started to tick up. And then right around 2015, they saw a dramatic decrease in how much prison they've been using in the justice reinvestment crimes. So that's the property and drug crimes. And this coincides directly with what we've seen in our experience of working with Marion County, of setting up programs, working and enhancing their 416 program. And so what we'll be asking them and every other county to do, and not all counties look like this. This is a great example in terms of a county that's done tremendous work in changing how they use prison. Some counties go up. Some counties have gone up. So whether you're a county that has decreased your prison usage or increased prison usage in this justice reinvestment area, for your application, you have to react to your real data. What did you do? And then in Marion County's case, we'd expect their application to say, this is how we intend to continue this work. In some of the counties where maybe their prison usage has increased, we would expect them to react to that and say, this is how we intend to address that increase, this is our strategy, and this is how we think the justice reinvestment dollars will help us accomplish that goal.
Mr. Kerr.
Senator Stanton Hayward.
Thank you. Just a comment, if I may, and this came up at some level in the Human Services Subcommittee some weeks ago when the Public Health Division was testifying during Phase 1. Oregon ranks among the top states in the nation for using evidence-based policy to direct our spending. And this is a classic example of it. And it's exactly what we should be doing, because everybody who contributes to our budget through his or her taxes should know that we're spending their dollars wisely, and being able to have these real-time data that allow the public to see what we're doing increases transparency, increases trust in government, and increases reassurance for the legislature that when we spend money, it's going toward programs that make sense. And so I really appreciate the work that the CJC has put into developing this website and making it so user-friendly and transparent, because it gives me, and I think many of us, a lot more confidence in how these dollars are being spent, and that we're actually getting the kind of ROI in terms of human potential and cost savings that we hoped we would most of the time.
Co-Chair Winters.
I just need to add, because if you look at the graph, the other thing that happened in realizing that Marion County realized that there was an uptick, and which then they stopped and did an analysis of why there was an uptick. And I know some of the other counties, and looking at it, you know, everything was, the analysis was everything from what was happening in parole and probation, you know, whether or not, you know, there was some violations that occurred that did not have to occur. So there was a real analysis that took place about that time that actually began to, for Marion County, to change some of the practices and the way they were doing business. So,
thank you to both senators. That is precisely how we intend this data to be used, so that counties can have real-time feedback. And this data lags about a month. So, I mean, counties can actually have this, see how they're performing, and react to that and make policy decisions. So Marion County is a great example of how we hope all counties work with the data. The only thing I'll add to this graph here, which I think is pertinent to this conversation, is we allow, there's a drop-down menu here for you to look at this gender specifically. So we all know that our female prison population is of concern, especially right now. So you can look at Marion County or any other county and click on the female drop-down tab and see, because sometimes counties might be decreasing prison usage overall, but you would see that the female prison usage is going up, or vice versa. And so this allows counties to really target and react to specifically either the female or the male populations. So the final piece on this graph, and so as our commissioners and as our grant review committee and everybody is reviewing the applications that the counties are submitting, they will also have this data. And this is exactly what they'll be working off of to see exactly how the county should be tailoring its goals with its justice reinvestment dollars. The final one is using the Oregon Uniform Crime Reports, the UCR reports. And what we're trying to do here is get at public safety and look at, is crime increasing in your communities? And so here you can see, and this goes back to 1990, so this is a much broader scale, but you can see what the crime rates have done. So here's the statewide, and here's Marion County. You'll notice a huge drop-off in the statewide numbers in 2015. That's actually not accurate. We're missing a significant portion of agencies reporting in 2015 due to a technology project in the metro region. It's actually the region data project, where a lot of law enforcement agencies have not been reporting their data. So in 2015, the state of Oregon has something like only 60% of law enforcement agencies reporting their uniform crime data. We hope that that will be remedied when that system comes online and we can backfill this data. Unfortunately, unlike prison data that we are, it's in the state's control, we're very on top of, and we update it monthly, the UCR data severely lags in time. So we have, our most current data right now is from 2015. But still, this allows a county to look at their specific UCR crime reports up to 2015 and hopefully gives them some more information to react from so that if they saw dramatic increases in property crimes, which is represented by the green line here, they could build that into their application and say, you know, one of the reasons we intend to use our justice reinvestment dollars for this is because of our increase in property crime rates, you know. So again, it's getting them to look at their specific data, react to it, and tell us how using these dollars is going to help them address their specific issues. So that open to the public, you know, on our website, anyone can go on and use it. But of course, it's targeted to the counties and the LIPSICs to use this data as they form their plans.
So I'll just go back.
Just briefly, the last time I presented in front of you, we hadn't had the April prison forecast yet. So I just wanted to incorporate that so you could see that it really hasn't changed remarkably much. So this is where we actually are, the black line. And then the blue line is where we're projected to go. The April forecast still goes out to 2027 in this slide, and we still are not crossing that Junction City line to have that facility up and built, whereas without the Justice Reinvestment Program, we were projected to need to have a prison open by February of 2017. The female prison population numbers are a little bit more challenging. You can see the red line represents the 1280 capacity of Coffee Creek. Our current numbers are above that. As of today, I believe we were around 1310 in the total. The April forecast has us staying above that line. The one thing that I'll say about that 1310 number is that it doesn't incorporate the Marion County Work Release Program, which represents, I believe, 16 right now female offenders. So it's actually 16 less than what the current number says, which still does have us above the 1280 line. We're continuing, obviously this is of a concern to everybody, and the forecast does have us in the short term continuing to rise, and we're actually tracking that forecast pretty closely. So we're still looking into other options in terms of short-term solutions. Any statutory law changes, anything of that nature, takes a long time to phase in. Where you can see that we just have this short-term rise where we're above the 1280, but then we stay really relatively flat for the foreseeable future, according to the most recent forecast. So programs like the Work Release Program represent an immediate reduction in that population, and if we can get that reduction, we think it'll hold for the long term to keep us below that line. So we're continuing conversations. We're hopeful that perhaps we're still having conversations with Jackson County to see if it's still a possibility, whether or not they would be a site for a work release program.
Can what happened with the regional approach with Jackson, Klamath, and Josephine?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, those conversations, for some reason or another, and I'm not entirely sure why, they stalled out. My understanding is that there's still a willingness to continue having those conversations among all three counties. So we will be continuing to work with them to see if we can find any solutions to any roadblocks that there are there. And so we're hopeful that we can continue to work on that.
And I very much hope that I have an opportunity to, I'm saying this as a general for anybody who might be watching, if you were involved in those conversations, I would love to chit-chat with you, given that that's my district, on what's going on and how I can help and how we can make sure that that gets to where it needs to be so it can happen.
So with that, that's my justice reinvestment update for you all. Might be a natural pausing place if anyone else has a question on justice reinvestment.
Questions? All right.
Okay. The specialty courts program. The Criminal Justice Commission, our two big general fund grants are specialty courts and justice reinvestment. The specialty courts grant program, we invested about $15 million this current biennium into 36 courts across the state. Specialty courts is a more umbrella term, so that encompasses mental health courts, veteran courts, adult drug courts, of course, family courts, juvenile courts. So it's kind of the umbrella term. But we fund 36 of those courts across the state. We are aware of the existence of 76 of those courts across the state. So through this grant, we fund about half of the specialty courts that are run in the state. So when I was asked to come and talk, I was asked some specific questions about how does an offender wind up in court, and what do they actually do, and how are they funded? Because the CJC grant funding alone is frequently not sufficient to run a court. So I've asked the district attorney from Washington County, Bob Herman, to come and give you some of those answers.
Thank you, Mike. Co-chairs Winters and Stark, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about our drug court. And I thought in answering those specific questions, it might be helpful to...
Maybe I just missed it. Did you officially say your name for the record?
I did not, but I will. My name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County.
Thank you.
Thanks. I thought it would be helpful to talk a little bit about our drug court and then what kind of makes sense how somebody winds up in it. The mission we've held pretty true. Our drug court has been in existence for a little over 12 years now. And last Monday, we have a graduation ceremony when people graduate from drug court. We just graduated our 189th individual from court on last Monday. We've got a slew of them set up in the coming weeks. Our mission is to change people's lives, break the cycle of addiction, reunite families, and promote community safety. And although that's a mission and a slogan, it really kind of captures what our drug court has been able to accomplish. An eligible defendant must plead guilty to criminal charges and is then placed on probation and then must participate in our drug court program. You must be in the drug court program for at least 15 months. You can't graduate before 15 months. It involves several treatment sessions a week, frequent drug testing, reporting to a probation officer, home visits from a sheriff's deputy, and weekly appearances in court to report to the judge and actually have a conversation with the judge. And there are five stages in our drug court, so one can move along through the stages, but that gives you an idea about the intensity of this. And in fact, it's not unusual for someone to be offered the opportunity to go to drug court or to go to prison for 24 to 36 months, and they opt for prison because they believe, from what they've learned and what they've heard, that drug court is too difficult for them. And many that have gotten through say they never thought they could have made it through the program. We also have a tension now with justice reinvestment programs. They kind of weigh the program one versus the other and try to figure out what's the easiest one for them sometimes. So just the fact that this is 15 months minimum, and we've had people in it, it's not unusual for graduates to have been there 2.5 to 3 years.
And understand it, Hayward?
Thank you so much. Nice to see you. 15 months, that's the evidence that suggests that that's the right period of time, or I'm not arguing, I'm curious, right? I'm just trying to understand, because you talk about people trying to choose what's going to be the better way to go.
Sure. Co-chair Senator Hayward, it's been a product. When we started, we didn't have a limit, and so we didn't have a time frame when we started our drug court. And so it's evidence-based through our experiences in a very good way in terms of how long it takes successfully to get through the programs. We always say at the graduation, you're just starting now that you've graduated because nobody's looking over your shoulder anymore. So it is a combination. I'm not an expert on all the statistics that deal with drug courts, but it is a combination of evidence-based information from other drug courts, but certainly in our experience, 15 months is a prerequisite. And as I said, most people, I think the average stay is about, got it here, but it's like 680 days.
Hmm. Okay, thank you.
So, answering kind of the question, well, how do you get into drug court? So,
Bob, just a quick question.
Yes.
And it is good seeing you again.
Thank you. You too.
Do you continue to follow? How long do you continue to follow after they have completed either the 15-month or
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, yes, we do. We have recently gone back with all our graduates, run their criminal histories, and determine, you know, up to 5 years, you know, how they're doing. So we do follow them. We've learned a really important component of Drug Court, which we didn't have initially, was an alumni association, and we've learned it from the graduates that it's really important to have something like that going, and so we've got a fairly vibrant alumni association. In fact, at the graduation, the chair of the alumni association comes and speaks to the graduate.
I'll say, if you have not had an opportunity to go and witness Drug Court, I would encourage you to. It's fantastic watching. It's different than one might expect. I'm a big fan of it. I have a close family member. After 20 years on meth, it took Drug Court is what finally got her clean. And, you know, she's been sober 2.5 years now. So I love what you guys do, and sometimes that's what it takes to get someone across that line. So
how do you get into Drug Court? Well, in our Drug Court, you have to commit a lot of crimes. I remember when we first looked into this, our presiding judge was Judge Marco Hernandez, who's now a federal judge, and he'd used to work in my office. In fact, I was his supervisor, and he said, "Well, look, I want to put together a drug court. What do you think about that?" And I said, "This was 12 years ago, and I have to admit, I said, I'm not too excited about that. What did you have in mind?" And he said, "Well, I want you to go to a training and see what you think. Keep an open mind." And I said, "I will, but I can see using it on kind of first-time offenders." So I went to a training and kept an open mind, fortunately, and discovered that, you know, our money really wasn't going to be well spent if we just dealt with first-time offenders, that we needed to look at the higher risk group. And the judge and I had a good talk about it. Judge Tom Cole ran our drug court for 10 years, and I remember him looking at me and saying, "Do you want to take high-end property offenders and put them in drug court and run that risk?" And I said, "Do you?" And we both said no, but the evidence-based information and the people we heard from suggested there was with intensive treatment and hard work, it could be done. So we take high-end property offenders and chronic probation violators, and I can tell you, it was a few nervous times when we started out. We've had people with sentences up of 120 months in prison hanging over their heads for property offenses. And I have to say, as prosecutor, they were well-earned in terms of their lengthy criminal history. But so we have invested in some pretty high-risk people. To get into drug court, you've got to be in that situation, and then you have to meet legal criteria. So, as I said, it's property crimes. We have some exclusions about their prior criminal history because they're very closely paired together, both in housing and treatment and so forth, and so we're concerned about the impact of influence of some upon others. They're scored out, so to be eligible, they must have moderate to high risks for criminogenic risk, including criminal recidivism. So that's another big gulp factor. They must have high scores for criminogenic needs, which is a severe substance abuse disorder. So we take some people that are pretty broken and pretty active in the criminal system in our program. Referrals, when we first started out, the most unlikely source of referrals were from police officers and jail corrections officers. We got people that were working drugs and working property offenses, and they knew who a lot of these people were because they were constantly recycling through our jails, coming back from prison. And so we had a lot of referrals from people from officers that said, "You know, I think this person, they get through their addiction, they get through this problem, you know, has a good chance of success." And that was rather unusual initially from that source. Nowadays, more and more we get our referrals from our probation officers, from judges, primarily from our deputy district attorneys who do the same thing. They look at the case, they look at their history, they kind of look at who they are, and from defense lawyers. So they refer those people. They're then run through the scoring, if you will, the risk assessments. In our county, the DA is the gatekeeper, so we can exclude somebody from drug court. But we have a staffing team, which is gets to the funding part. We have a staffing team in our court that involves the judge. Judge Cole ran it for 10 years. Now Judge Beth Roberts runs our drug court. She was actually a prosecutor assigned for my office in the drug court before she became a judge. We have a deputy district attorney. We have a defense attorney, someone from the public defender's office who, going to the cost thing, they don't get compensated by the state in any manner for their participation in drug court, which is interesting because they put a lot of time in it, and it's a significant saver for the community. But that's how it's worked out contractually, I guess. We've got two treatment providers from CODA. We have a DHS worker assigned to our treatment team, a specialty team, two mentors, a male and female mentor, a probation officer. We have a coordinator. The funding from that comes from CJC, but it's a state employee, so the money is funded. It's hired by the state, works for the court, but the money is a pass-through through the CJC money. And a sheriff's deputy. When I went to the training, I remember I was sitting next to our undersheriff at the training, and we turned to the table next to us, big groups from different states, and it was a group from Texas, and our undersheriff asked, they said, so which one of you guys is from law enforcement? And they looked at us like we had three eyes, and they said, our sheriff doesn't agree with this program. So, which was kind of surprising, and we found out that wasn't unusual in the room, but what's been a huge value to this drug court is the participation of our sheriff's deputy. Not so much at all for the enforcement feature of the home visits, but it's kind of the standard line is that the people in drug court most often go to the sheriff's deputy than they do their defense attorney, because they have some real-life problems. They've got people that are bothering them, people that they're living with. They have problems with the law or concerns about getting stopped because they always got stopped before because everybody knew who they were and they had drug problems. And so we couldn't do it without them. And again, from the funding standpoint, those funds for that deputy come from our public safety law enforcement fund, so they're not grant funded either. That's, if you will, a commitment by the now two sheriffs to do that. And so that staffing committee meets weekly and staffs the cases, reports to the court. And so all that process really is involved in who ends up in the specialty court. And again, one of the standing kind of lines is it's unusual that sometimes you would not know if you didn't know the players, you wouldn't know who was in what role. Sometimes the DAs are advocating for leniency and the defense attorney is advocating for a more severe sanction when they're in the staffing meetings, because the advocacy pieces still remain in place, but as they should in this system, but people are focused on what's best for this individual. And it's unique in that often in probations, if you have a dirty UA, you're gone, you're revoked. Here it's, I don't want to say it's expected, but it's understood, and that there's going to be some time frame. We primarily deal with meth addiction, and now a huge increase in heroin addiction, typically young people with heroin addiction, different treatment modalities, different reactions, but kind of the understanding that and the graduates talk about this all the time is that these people are here to help them to succeed, and so that whole mentality I think helps with the with the program. And so what do they do? I think I've talked a little bit about that. I didn't mention that they can get their charges dismissed at the conclusion of probation. For some, they have pretty lengthy criminal histories, so it's not a big deal in terms of their record, but it's a big deal in terms of putting that indictment in the shredder. We've had individuals who have paid their restitution after graduating from drug court and having no obligations whatsoever, have continued paying some longstanding restitution obligations. As I said, there's five phases, and it's employment, drug-free lifestyles, clean and sober housing, critical. We're fortunate in our county to have, not enough, but to have clean and sober housing that a lot of these individuals are involved in. And so from a funding perspective, as I mentioned, there's a lot of funding. In my office, we have a deputy DA that's dedicated, and those funds don't come from the CJC grant either. They come from the county budgets. We work really well together in departments, so we get some money from the community corrections budget to help fund part of our deputy district attorney. Health and Human Resources devotes about $120,000 for alcohol and drug services. And the CJC money goes to our coordinator, rental subsidies, UAs, lots of UAs. At each graduation, usually the court recites the number of UAs that the graduate has performed. And it's like, even though you know they've been in it a long time, it's pretty staggering. It's in the hundreds. We've tried to track statistics over the years, and it's numbers are numbers, but I know you'll all appreciate the in terms of the decisions you make and so forth, just the benefits from a number standpoint. So our graduates have paid over $191,000 in restitution, and I can tell you, with this population, with their criminal history, and if they'd gone to prison, the restitution collection would be not even close to that amount. And so oftentimes when we talk to victims about somebody's going into drug court, I mean, they've been, like I said, these have been prolific property offenders. And one of the things we talk about is, well, you may well see your restitution in this case over a few years, and you probably won't if they go another route. That's an important thing for victims. We did the numbers, so with all our graduates, if you take their prison sentences and their county jail sentences, now these numbers are overstated because we know if somebody gets 34 months in prison, they're not going to serve 34 months in prison, short-term transitional leave programs. Some of them might. Some of them may have no programs at all. But just taking those straight sentences, our graduates have been had over their heads 340 years of prison time and 18 years of county jail time. And assuming $30,000 per year, that's about over $10 million in savings for them not to go to prison and graduate from our program. And probably more importantly, I think, are these numbers. 24 drug-free babies have been born to participants in our drug court. And again, like I said, as you can imagine, these high-risk folks, that number would be dramatically less, and that's a huge saving. 162 children have regained a clean and sober parent. And as I said, I didn't say, but we have a graduation. I try to attend every one that I can, and I've lost count. I can count it on the weight scales because we have a cake from Beaverton Bakery, and I've yet to find a piece of cake that I don't like.
Especially from Beaverton Bakery.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
That's a challenge.
But I've seen time and time again, the ceremonies are very moving because I read all their past criminal history in Washington County, and I see the victimization often of their family members, grandma, mom and dad, and parents, and you see the pain, and you hear the families talk about, you know, how important it is. I know Representative Barker, I think, was at a graduation or two, and it's everyone has a different story, and it's very moving, and that's something you can't put a dollar amount on. So hopefully that summary kind of gives an example of how our court works.
Understand it, Hayward?
Thank you very much. And I don't know if this is the right time to ask this question. If it's not, I'll put it off. But thank you, first of all, for the really clear explanation of how your drug court is working, and I think it's a really good example of how we're using resources to actually address the root cause as opposed to just punishing people, and it makes a big difference in the long term. I know, Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Herman, that we have other kinds of specialty courts. One of the things I don't know is, I've been doing a little bit of reading recently based on the neuroscience about brain development, about young adult courts, where you take certain individuals in that 18 to 24 or 16 to 24 who would otherwise be tried as adults, but who have, especially when we know more about trauma-informed practices, we know that their brain development may be significantly lagging behind because of childhood traumas, are put into a different path, part of which is in some ways a lot like drug court. They're fairly intensive treatment and things like that. Do you guys know if there's anything, is anybody talking about doing that here in Oregon?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, we do fund some juvenile and family courts. So there are younger participants in a few of our courts. The research on juvenile courts has been pretty mixed. And so that's not to, it doesn't directly get at your brain development question, but there are programs that do focus on that as an alternative to a more traditional incarcerative path. But the research that we've seen nationally is mixed on their efficacy.
Good to know. Thank you. Evidence. It's good.
Co-Chair Winters.
Thank you, Coach O'Stark. You know, we're really concerned about the uptick in the female population. And, of course, as you know, that the majority of those are property crimes with also with the drug combination. What percentage of the participants in your drug court are women?
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, the percentage of the graduates is it's changed. It's changed a little bit, but it's roughly 52% men, 48% women. And I can tell you to that question because we have an FSAP program, and I can't remember the name of the bills, but it's or even what FSAP stands for, but it's
Sing Alternative Program.
Thank you. We have a rich population, and quite frankly, in our jail, the forced releases of our jail weekly are women because we don't have enough room in our jail capacity. And it's a rich population for our drug court. What we've seen is we kind of have another. We have a lot of little funny jokes, or we think they're funny. Drug court, and one of them is the graduates all laugh, and the people in the drug court all laugh. And we say, you can't just hit you on the head with a magic wand and get you from where you were to where you are today when you're graduating. And that's one of the things about our drug court, and it's one of the challenges with some of the other courts. There's so much beyond the addiction that's at play. It needs resource. It really needs resource and intensity, I guess, to get at some of the underlying issues. And like I said, I'm probably one of the reasons I'm here is I'm a big believer in drug court. I've come from one spot to another, and I think to the extent that we have more of those opportunities for some intense programs, we have the same opportunity for successes that we see through this type of program.
Thank you. Some of us, have really been, trying to look at, particularly through justice reinvestment, if we were fortunate enough to have some of the resources that I know that some of you have asked us for in order to provide some of those services that you actually talked about, and those are some of the alcohol and drug treatment and housing and some of those other components. Would that help a lot in facilitating the work that you do with drug courts? And I see DA Underhill back there doing like this.
And that's not nodding off, that's agreeing with
you. Co-chair Senator Winters, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, it's there's, as I said, there is the histories, and that's why the length of this program and the intensity of this program. I mean, the history is that many of the women that we see in our drug court have through their addiction and other issues. You know, it takes a while. It takes resource, and it takes clean and sober housing. It takes opportunities. But if you look at the return, it's one of those things that it's money spent up front and money that you don't have to spend. That's always hard to, you know, to balance out in the checkbook. But as a practical matter in the book of reality, it's a huge area for opportunity.
Follow-up. Were you in any way able to calculate what the cost that we may have been paying as a state for the 162 children? You mentioned the children, and so, I mean, we often calculate the cost to the public safety community, but not to the other part of our community, which is DHS and some of the other places that where it costs if we don't get into the preventive side, it's costing us both more than just prison beds.
That is true.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Winters, I actually asked for that statistic a number of years ago. I said I want to add up all the children that are impacted by this, and it comes from and the answer is no. We haven't tried to calculate a cost. I just know, as a longtime prosecutor, that I probably prosecuted grandchildren of defendants that I originally had. I know I've prosecuted, I mean, great-grandchildren. I know I've prosecuted grandchildren and children over my career. And there is, again, it's one of those things that's hard to put a measure on. But, you know, breaking the cycle within a family, and again, you see it a lot at the graduations where these kids will get up and talk, 12, 13 years old, and like I say, it's very powerful when they get up and talk about a parent that they never had, and they've seen them work, and now they have a parent. And that, you'd like to think, translates in a lot of ways to their successes or better chance of success than the opposite. I wish I had a number, but it's high.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to give you some figures about our specialty court program in terms of the applications that we have coming in. This chart, so we have a total of 41 courts have applied to the CJC for funding in this upcoming biennium. And what that would have represented would be if we funded all of those courts at the rates that we set those courts for funding at, that would represent almost $20 million in requests for funding from across the state for 41 different courts. Like I said, in the prior biennium, we had about $15 million. And so current service level would continue us at about $15 million. So even at that level, we are prepping our commission to have to make some tough decisions about what courts will end up being funded, or whether or not all the courts can be reduced, the rate at which they are funded. So there's some things that our commission's really going to have to wrestle with. In anticipation of a tough fiscal year, as we knew that this was coming up and working off of the governor's budget, staff went ahead and asked the applicants to apply at a daily rate that was reduced by 25%. And so that's at a 25% reduction across the board for all courts at our funding rate. Then all 41 courts would represent $14.5 million in requests if our commission decided to stay at that rate but fund everybody. And like DA Herman has already said, I'm positive in saying all of our courts, you know, they are putting in their own resources. Our dollars, even at the higher rate, are not enough to completely fund these courts for what the local contributions are. So at the reduced rate, $14.5 million, current service level would be enough to cover all 41 applications at the reduced rate, but that's also a 25% reduction across the board in our grant funds to the courts. And And clearly, you know, that's a tough that's also a tough scenario for the courts. So it's up to our commissioners to balance what that looks like.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
This really does bring up the biggest challenge that we face as we think about budgets, right? Because based on the data that Mr. Herman gave us, one could anticipate fairly substantial savings from bed days in DOC custody were we to fund these adequately, right, and with the contributions. But that means we have to have the money to make the upfront investment. And we have the prison population. We can't kick them out. And I'm not, it's more of a comment than a question, but it, I think it's important for us to be thinking really hard about this, just as Mr. Herman was talking about trying to break the cycle of prosecuting great-grandchildren of people he prosecuted. I'd kind of like to perpetuate, to break the cycle of putting people in prison and keeping our DOC population high, which means we don't have the money to spend on things that have been shown to decrease our prison population and create what I would call the double delta. We're not spending the money on keeping them in prison. We are we are getting tax revenue because they're tax-paying citizens. There's no good answer to that, but I think it is really important to have to be very explicit about the kinds of choices that we're trying to make when we're in a revenue-constrained situation and we're constrained by the mandatory minimums that Measures 11 and 57 have put upon us. So I'll stop speechifying, but I think this points out very clearly. We know these courts save us money, mm-hmm. a lot of money.
So I received a question from Representative Stark, from Co-Chair Stark, specifically about the governor's recommended budget. And so I attempt to address that here in these next couple slides. What happened in the governor's requested budget was the general fund allocation for specialty courts was decreased by $3.5 million. However, it was kept whole by increasing our other funds limitation to put into specialty courts and increasing our federal fund limitation to put into specialty courts. What that essentially means for the – I'll start with other fund because that's easier. Other fund is our asset forfeiture dollars. And so we pretty much count on receiving $500,000 over the biennium to CJC from asset forfeiture. We get a percentage of the total forfeited proceeds that go statutorily to specialty courts. So we had already in our budget had $500,000 going from those other funds. This would essentially put not only the $500,000 that we have right now that we've amassed through this biennium, but also the anticipated $500,000 that we would collect in the next biennium. So it really would be a one-time $500,000 all-in fund shift to accomplish that. The federal fund side is slightly more tricky. So the money that is in the governor's budget that would be putting in to the specialty courts is our federal burn JAG dollars. And these are dollars that our commission has had the discretion to spend as needs arise throughout a biennium in previous biennia. So what this proposal would essentially do, we were already, for current service level, anticipating putting in about $1.6 million from federal burn JAG dollars into the specialty courts. This would put in all of the burn JAG dollars that we anticipate receiving in this upcoming biennium. So we haven't even applied for those dollars yet. We have not received them. And with the conversations around sanctuary cities and states, they are not even a sure thing. But obviously, you know, this is a tricky thing to anticipate all that, especially during the governor's budgeting process. So that's one of the risk areas of that allocation, is just because hopefully those dollars will be there and we'll continue to receive them. But there is a little bit of uncertainty around that. The other thing that that would do by decreasing the general fund and then increasing our limitation and putting all our federal funds is the programs that the commission has supported in the past with those funds, we would not be able to do new programs similar to those that we've done in the past. So what I'm trying to distinguish there is that programs that we've already funded with these funds, but maybe we'll continue on going, that money's been allocated. We've applied for it from the federal government. So the governor's budget didn't anticipate us going backwards and taking out those funds, but it just prospectively was looking at any incoming funds. And so what I have on this slide is just some examples of programs that the CJC, our commission, has voted to support over the course of this this biennium. And these are all things that many of which come up during the biennium that, that we didn't necessarily anticipate, but needs arose and opportunities arose for innovative programs. So I don't need to read these, but one of the big ones, we are supporting the Center for Policing Excellence with these. We're just about to launch a victimization survey in Oregon. That's something that we do not have. Statutorily, the CJC is obligated to make racial and ethnic impact statements that incorporates victim data. That's not something that we have the capacity to do because we do not have that data in Oregon. So we are very excited about the prospect of, for the first time, launching an Oregon-specific victimization survey so we can start to get at those numbers. So those are just a few of the examples of things that our federal burn jag dollars have supported. And then the Justice Reinvestment Summit, which I think some of you got to attend. We had over 1,000 people registered in the end. 889 people walked through the doors to spend 2 days in Salem and talk about all of our justice reinvestment programs. All the feedback that I've gotten has been extremely positive, and I think we continue to see to this day lipsticks and the reverberations of that summit, of those things continuing to be discussed. So that's another example of a program that's supported by our federal burn jag dollars. And so to talk a little bit more about specifically how the burn jag dollars work from the county side is our newest, and I didn't even label him Multnomah County District Attorney. I labeled him CJC Commissioner, DA Rod Underhill, because as effective of June 1st, that is what he can add to his title. But we have worked with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office on a couple of different burn jag specific grants that our commission has approved. So I've asked Rod to be here today to talk about that.
Well, good afternoon, co-chairs Winters and Stark, members of the Ways and Means Committee, Rod Underhill, your Multnomah County District Attorney, and newly a member of the CJC as commissioner. Although I don't think the Senate has quite confirmed me yet, so we'll hold on to that for a moment. Hey, well, first, thank you. I'm going to count on your vote, Senator, I hope. So thank you for this opportunity to speak. Thank you, CJC, for this request to make comment about the value of the flexible funding aspect of the CJC's budget. That flexible funding aspect has allowed for, as Mr. Schmidt just summarized, just that, some ability to be flexible with new programs or developing programs once budgets that have already been established. I'll give you two. I have come prepared to talk about two very good examples, or I like what I think there are two very good examples here during this biennium that I've played a role in. I'll start with our Treatment First program, largely because it kind of segues from what you've already heard relative to drug treatment programs. Mr. Herman talked about Washington County's version. By way of background, here within the last about 12 months, I think, led a adjustment, if you will, in Multnomah County's approach to possession of controlled substances. This is not a time to go into a deep dialogue about the LEAD-based program, but those of you who have heard about LEAD, I was a champion in helping to bring LEAD to our community. We opened the doors, if you will, to the LEAD program back in February of this year. And so it is up and running, but it is also, by way of background, it is also a geographically restricted, it's a portion of Multnomah County, essentially a large downtown core area up and around our Lloyd Center, and encompasses about 25% of our possession of a controlled substance referrals to the district attorney's office. That program is a harm reduction and is a pre-booking diversion for user amounts plus. It's kind of a broad description of user amounts of possession of controlled substance, and essentially does not result in a prosecution at all. This segues into the rest of the county by way of example. As I was developing the LEAD program, I was also wanting to be fair and balanced as it relates to the rest of Multnomah County. Talking about the entire county from a rough number standpoint, we're talking about an additional 1,200 or so referrals to my office for felony possession of controlled substance prosecution. Those jurisdictions are going to include, of course, Mid-County. They're going to include North, Northeast Portland, Gresham. They're going to include a broad array. So that began, or I should say, continued me down a path of wanting to recalibrate our drug court system to both institute the new LEAD program, but also to balance out the rest of the county. So currently, so with that thought in mind, I began conversations with the bench, of course. Judge Jones, Chief Criminal Judge Jones in our jurisdiction has played a very significant role in what I'm giving you background on. The defense bar, all system partners needed to work with me on overhauling essentially our drug court methodology. One of the major adjustments I made is in consultation with local law enforcement leaders, all of them, and receiving a unanimous support of this direction to go in from both the sheriff, the Gresham Chief of Police, Chief Sells, the Chief of Police from Portland, Chief Marshman, and others. Talked about a principle that felony drug possessions in Multnomah County, but for the substantial quantity, the highest amounts of possessions are going to be issued by my office as misdemeanors. And we have moved into that practice. That practice has been employed since April 3rd of this year. So those 1,200 or so cases, minus a few, are proceeding as misdemeanors outside of the LEAD-based conversation. What do we do next? Following arrest, we have implemented one of the many things, and this is where I'm going to segue into the flexible spending here in a moment. One of the many things that we're doing is something new and different in our jurisdiction and I think somewhat unique in the country, and that is following arraignment, we are assessing everyone with the assistance of counsel. They're going to have received counsel in this treatment first continuum. They are going to receive a risk and needs-based assessment administered by the Department of Community Justice. Those are the individuals that are qualified and prepared and trained to administer the LSCMI to both look at the risk of the individual and what needs need to be met in order to reduce that risk over time. And so that LSCMI is going to be complemented by another assessment tool called the AAI, which is going to do a deeper dive into the needs of the individual relative to specifics of dosage. We have developed a four-quadrant system in order to attempt to meet and tailor the treatment program to the needs of the specific individual. And so some individuals are going to come out of this assessment as high risk and high needs. Those are the individuals we're going to be talking about, some inpatient treatment or some very aggressive outpatient treatment. I'm going to go to the other end of the spectrum. You're going to have some individuals that are low risk and low needs. And we want to make sure that we're appropriately investing our resources into those who need it most, as contrasted with those who don't need it nearly as much. And so those that continuum needed to be subsidized, if you will. We needed revenue. And quite frankly, in consultation with both the judge, I'm going to add another actor into this very important continuum, and that is Scott Taylor from the Department of Community Justice up in Multnomah County. And simply put, we needed some money in order to have the capacity to do our vision, to give these LSCMI risk and needs assessment. They literally take high-trained individuals to administer appropriately those risk and needs tests. So the group of us, if you will, I think I was probably assigned the point guard, if you will, to reach out to Mr. Schmidt as the executive director of CJC and ask, simply put, for about $50,000 to get us going on our project and work us through the rest of this fiscal year. We were able to put together a plan, a request, meeting the needs and obligations of what he needed to present to his then board. I was asked and, of course, willingly participated in testifying, if you will, before that board, the Criminal Justice Commission commissioners, and received what I memory serves is a unanimous support of authorizing that $50,000, which has gone a long way to allowing us to simply put, get going back on April 3rd. So that flexible spending of the Byrne JAG grant money is, that's a direct example of us being able to really mid-stream come up with a good idea, we think, for our jurisdiction, and then implement it with the assistance of that flexible spending. I'll move aside, but certainly can come back if anybody has questions about what I've just summarized. And I'm going to shift over to a different program, if you will, another example of flexible spending. So another area of what I believe is a high need area is the notion of dedicated funding for witness intimidation relocation funding. So by way of background, now it's closing in on 30 years as a prosecutor, more directly probably closer to 28 or 29, I've experienced a lot of situations where individuals have been at high risk for retaliation, intimidation, and such, either actual or perceived. There are some actual examples, and I guess for me, one that crystallized my resolve to really become almost slightly obsessed with believing that we needed to do something about this was I worked with a individual who participated in a homicide some years ago. Helped with others, of course, solve that case. Entered into a cooperation agreement with him, if you will, and the federal government in a highly complicated scenario. His name was Robert Ford. Robert Ford, I worked with. He testified according to his obligations in some very high-profile matters. We relocated him under then-existing nickels and dimes put together. We needed him out of the jurisdiction because, quite frankly, we feared for his life. He was willing to go for a while, and I'm not sure, as I sit here today, that I would be able to, with this program, change the trajectory of what I'm about to talk to you about. But who knows? We were able to move him away for a little bit. He moved down to Sacramento, if memory serves me right. But then as the cases wound down and his obligations were resolved, he decided he wanted to come back to our jurisdiction. And despite me, I don't know if I'd call it begging, but maybe close, to don't come back because I thought he was still at high risk. He did. Mr. Ford was murdered. He was murdered in a parking lot, and he was murdered, we believe, investigatively, because he worked as a government's witness in some very serious prosecutions that I was involved in and my office was involved in. Those offenders, that shooter, have now been also convicted for their crime of being involved in the death of Robert Ford. But that, summarizing that for you, if you will, it's a lot more of a story to that. But if you will, that triple down, I guess, if you will, that we needed to come up with some dedicated funding that individuals in that category needed to have some ability to get away from those who want to do them harm or intimidate them as they choose to support a prosecution of someone who has committed a serious crime in our community. That had me reaching out to, I almost literally have had conversations across the U.S. with where can we come up with that money? There are essentially three states, now four counting us, that can say we have such dedicated funding. That dedicated funding brought me to conversations with Byrne, JAG grant administrators back in the East Coast, which then put me on to Mr. Schmidt again in CJC and some flexible spending in the area of Byrne and JAG. So as a result of that, I reached out to, once again, Mr. Schmidt to talk about that flexible spending. Could the Oregon District Attorney's Office, or Association, I mean, and not just the District Attorney of Multnomah County, but as a member of ODAA, could we put together a package that could help the entire state, not just Multnomah County, even though I certainly wanted that assistance as well? Mr. Schmidt was more than willing to listen. We once again spent a lot of detail. I'm going to hold up a small binder, if you will, of what we put together now. If you were able to see this up close, it would read the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We put together a quite detailed program that allows all 36 district attorneys to access funds that have been set aside through this flexible funding program when the need exists. Let me give you a quick example of a recent need. No sooner did we the ink was dry on the signatures of this program when my office made an application for some of that funding. My office, specifically Glenn Banfield, one of my senior deputies, and Deputy Eric Zimmerman, went in a process of prosecuting an individual named Xavier Bolden. Mr. Bolden had murdered an individual named Darrell Harris outside of the Fontaine Blue, one of our clubs downtown. He did it with numerous witnesses around. However, the state only called one eyewitness. The others were unwilling to participate. But the one that was willing to participate knew Mr. Bolden, went to high school with Mr. Bolden, and was at great risk when she chose to step forward and say what she saw, which was she saw Mr. Harris. All right, Mr. Bolden, kill Mr. Harris. She was being intimidated by the Hoover gang because Mr. Bolden was a member of our Hoover gang, a very dangerous gang in our community. And as such, she was at risk. We were able to apply for use of these funds. She was relocated in the short term. She has now testified at trial. That trial jury returned a guilty verdict. And the murderer of Mr. Harris, justice has prevailed, and Mr. Bolden has been sentenced. I can tell you that this witness that I'm referring to has been relocated out of the state because of the use of these flexible funds. Does she continue to be at risk? Yes, she does, I'm afraid. A lot like Mr. Ford was when he chose to return. We hope that we don't have those tragic endings. We believe that this funding example goes a long way toward making that a reality, that we don't have tragic examples of conclusions of individuals who are in those complicated situations and are at risk of testifying. It's not just limited to gang involved. We can envision human trafficking cases. I can envision domestic violence cases. It's not a one category only. This flexible funding, this money set aside by CJC to benefit victims around the state of Oregon, can run across all crime categories. We're very excited about the prospect of that. So in summary, these are two examples of the value of the ability for CJC to have a flexible fund capacity so that they can make the right decisions, or commission can make the right decisions at the right time when good ideas come up that benefit citizens in Oregon. Questions, if any?
I don't have a question, but thank you, Co-Chair Stark. But I can't leave without saying a thank you for, I know that you're actually assisting a lot in Multnomah County in work on I call it the front end and the back end bookends in order to actually change some of the trajectory that's going on. And I want to say thank you. Between Scott Taylor and Judge Waller and others, I have kept up with some of what you're doing in Multnomah County. And I do want to say thank you. You know, not all the members know you were part of the 3194.
Yes, I was. Spent a lot of time with you, co-chair, Senator Winters. But thank you very much.
Yes,
and thanks for your continued good work on that program as well, that bill.
I want to thank, because I know that all the lifting that takes place, and I understand the meetings that you're all having as a team working together to make things better. So I wanted to personally say thank you.
Thank you again.
Senator Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to thank you. We've had a lot of conversations as well, not as intense as the ones you probably had with Senator Winters, but we've had some pretty good conversations, and I want to thank you for the real holistic approach you're taking to this whole issue. It is not just how many people can we get arrested or how many people can we get convicted, but how can we stop the process going into the system? And I really want to thank you for that work.
Appreciate that, Senator Winters. Thank you very much.
Representative Huffman.
Continue to work together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rod?
Yes.
I want to thank you. Different subject, yes. but your support, J.R. Ujifusa, has been tremendously helpful in our trafficking work group, and I really appreciate you focusing on that, prioritizing it, and allowing J.R. to help us out.
Well, thank you. Human trafficking is a very important issue for all of us to get right, to work hard at, to have a balanced approach to it. J.R. Ujifusa helps me to look good and makes the office look good. And frankly, he makes the state of Oregon look good. I don't want to exaggerate and say it's every month that I'm authorizing him to go somewhere around the country and speak about the work we're doing here and specifically what he does. But it seems like that. It's close to that. Thank you for that. He deserves it. I'll pass on the message. Thank you.
right, thank you. And Mike, just a heads up, we're down to about 10 minutes, and I know you have two more people still.
Yep. So very briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one more program to talk about our federal burn JAG dollars. The CJC applied for a justice reinvestment maximizing federal grant. We received $875,000. We were hoping to receive $1.7 million for that grant, but they essentially cut it in half. That would not have allowed us to do what we really wanted to do in the grant, which was to cover funding for LIPSC coordinators in as many counties as we possibly could do that. So we got $875,000, which was great, but it took the addition of $1 million of burn JAG funds to make that program what we anticipated it would be. And so I have asked the director, Mike MacArthur, and Kelly Minty Morris to come and talk to you about their experience with that program.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties, Executive Director here to talk about the LIPSC grant program that we're working with in partnership with Community the Criminal Justice Commission on. I'd like to introduce Commissioner Kelly Minty Morris from Klamath County to talk to you about her experience with this program.
Great, and thank you, Co-Chair Representative Stark and Co-Chair Senator Winters, members of the committee. Also, thank you for the time check. That's always helpful. And my remarks will be 3 minutes or less, so I will be very, very quick. Again, Commissioner Kelly Minty Morris, and I should also point out that it was only due to the scheduling issue that you ended up getting me and not my colleague from Josephine County, so you officially got, you know, the second place or second string or whatever you want to call it. So a few things that I really, really like. You know, I'm from Klamath County, so I really, really like Southern Oregon wines. I like power yoga. Somebody brought up cake earlier, which I'm also a big fan of, actually just eating frosting out of a jar, hence the power of yoga. But something that I truly like, probably more than all those things, are when we in leadership, when we have the opportunity to get a creative win. And I don't know if we have those opportunities very often. We have a lot of competing needs coming at us at all times, particularly when it comes to where we put resources. So when we have the opportunity for a creative win, I think it's really important that we seize those opportunities. And I really view the addition of these LIPSC coordinators as those people that can lead us as leaders to those creative wins. And that's why I'm so supportive of the program. We talk a lot about how in the past at the LIPSC meetings, you have all the best players around the table. You have your law enforcement, you have your mental health people, all these really smart people, and they come up with these great ideas and they go to conferences and trainings. And, you know, they've each got maybe a shiny, we call it sometimes the shiny ball, right? Oh, we can do this. But if you don't have someone to actually hold up the shiny ball and remind them at the next meeting, hey, remember, you like this so much, and actually get it to implementation, you don't get to go anywhere. So I really view the LIPSC coordinators as the people who can take the shiny ball, and if you want to use a sports metaphor, you know, take the ball and run with it, or just, again, hold up that shiny ball. I told you that I really like the opportunity for a creative win, and if you remember nothing else about what I say, I hope you remember that, because it's really that opportunity. And since I've shared with you that I like creative ways to win, you probably don't want to play a board game with me, because, you know, I always find a way to bend the rules a little bit. But in all seriousness, I'll just briefly share with you an example of a way that we found a creative win in Klamath County. It's not specific to the LIPSC, but I think it's I just want you to have that in your mind as you weigh this. I'm somebody who's really passionate about health and wellness. I've got to have some great conversations with Senator Steiner Hayward about this. And yet we had this huge need related to that right at our county that we could do something about. We have many of our county services services, our jail, our juvenile department, our public health, all sit up on a hill. And at the bottom of that hill is a really beautiful bike and walking trail that our public works department put in that's used consistently. But when people, clients at the jail and juvenile and parole and probation and our own staff, when they wanted to get down to that trail, it was very unsafe. You go around a blind corner, down a steep hill. And so you had people wanting to utilize this great resource and not a safe way to do it. And if somebody said, you know, well, can't we have a trail that connects to the trail? And immediately my wheels start going, oh God, that's going to cost money. We have no money. That's what we say all the time, right? We don't have money. And but I loved the idea. And I just thought we have to figure out a way to make this happen. So me being the person willing to carry the shiny ball in that respect, because I was so passionate about it, found out, well, gosh, you know, we're probably going to have to pay for engineers to design something. We can't just throw up a trail. But we have Oregon Tech in our backyard with engineering students that need projects. And lo and behold, they were willing to do it. And then it was, oh, but who's going to do all the physical labor? We can't pay someone to do that. Well, community corrections clients need those kind of projects. And it was particularly good for them because then they could literally see the fruits of their labor on a regular basis as they go up to check in. And then finally, you know, well, where do we get the materials? Well, Public Works had just finished a major chip seal project and had some, whatever they call them, leftover that we could use. So my long-winded way of saying that we were, in a couple months, we're going to have this beautiful, new, very functional trail that didn't, I don't want to say it's free. We never say it's free, right? But it was with no additional resources. So I just wanted to highlight for you an example of a creative win when you have somebody willing to hold up the shiny ball. That's what these lipstick coordinators could do, and that's why I personally am very supportive of the program.
Representative Plouffe.
Well, Commissioner Morris, based on your enthusiasm and the success that you noted, and that you eat frosting out of a you're to the top string. You're first string. You're good. But excellent example of how we can be creative and really not spend a lot of money. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, briefly a little background how we got here with the Criminal Justice Commission and Association of Counties on this program. I, for about 8 years, chaired the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council at Sherman County from its inception, really, in about 1996 when we passed 1145, and saw the value of LIPSICS and saw the value of building relationships and understanding the roles of all the folks in the criminal justice system. So when I came to AOC, I learned about the Criminal Justice Commission, the great work they do, and our partnership with the Justice Reinvestment program has been very successful. So when they came to us and talked to us about adding additional staff to the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, it made sense to me because I knew how unsupported some LIPSICS were in some parts of the state. Some people just didn't have the resource. I made my juvenile director staff the thing, and he had plenty of other work to do. So we saw the value in doing that, and we also saw the value in having these LIPSICS coordinators work for county association rather than be state employees, because some people were kind of suspicious, frankly. So we entered into this partnership with the Criminal Justice Commission to hire from AOC 6 people to put out to staff 15 different local public safety and coordinating councils. In your area, Representative Huffman, there's a person doing all 5 for the Norcor region. We know that it's successful because in Multnomah County, they have a very robust staffing model that we think we can learn from. In several other larger counties, there are staffing models. So another thing that we're doing with these coordinators is bringing them together with the existing counties that have LIPSICS staff to learn from them. We've also been able to provide through the Policy Consensus Center particularly training on collaboration, which has been very helpful. We were lucky and I think a little bit careful in that we found 6 great people, 2 of them former committee administrators here, to be our coordinators. One of them has a law degree. One of them is a journalist who covered public safety. One of them is a former Commission on Children and Families chair. So we have a variety of experience. We bring them into Salem once a month to share experiences, to share best practices. Then they go to the criminal justice summits. They learn about evidence-based practices, take those back to their local public safety. The idea is to get them to be higher functioning, improve the system, and implement these programs that are going to reduce recidivism and make the system better.
So, Mike, not all the counties have been as eager to engage with JRI as Marion County, for example. So how has having these lipstick coordinators for some of those counties, how has it encouraged them to get involved, or has it?
Well, we started this in January. So we're just barely into the program. The coordinators are getting familiar with their territories. They're learning the personalities of the various folks involved, and they're being able to bring together stories, bring back stories about what is working. And I think that's what is going to be successful, is for them to see examples, to learn from others about what's been successful in their jurisdictions. I think there's a learning curve for all involved. Our people are, this is a new job. This job didn't exist except in a few places before, so they're learning how to do their job. Maybe I'll ask Commissioner Morris to talk about how it's working where she is on the ground with a LEPSIC.
Sure, and I'll be brief. So we have a coordinator, and an example that I was sharing with staff is that we had always talked about how great would it be if we had a mapping done that some counties do of how their criminal justice system works, every piece. But it was just something that nobody could ever find the time to actually schedule and get busy people to sit down. Well, he just sent me, I just have on my phone, a draft. So just some of those things that, again, are good ideas that everybody's really enthusiastic, to use your word, about, and yet they just weren't getting done, and now they're getting done, concrete projects.
And I'm going to answer my own question. So I do know of one county specifically that had not really been engaging. Their LEPSIC hadn't met for a long, long time. And with the idea of one of these coordinators, you know, I met with this commissioner and came in as very excited about what they actually can do. And all of a sudden, we're seeing people begin to engage, or conversations take place that we weren't necessarily having previously. So you guys did well, but I was giving you a chance to point that out. So, excellent. Mike, we have just a couple minutes left for you to wrap up with pending legislation.
Mr. Chair, so Mike Schmidt again, and I just put up here the bills that I know that are before you that impact the Criminal Justice Commission. So Senator Winters' bill, Senate Bill 1041, which would be tracking alcohol and drug money across the state, and in fact it's all senators' bill because I believe all 30 senators signed on to this bill as sponsors. Tasked the CJC with doing that analysis, working with our sister agencies, OIA, OHA, DHS, DOC, to track that money, and then starting to really look at the outcomes and try to see if we can put some, what are we getting, what's our return on investment for the alcohol and drug dollars. So that is pending before you. House Bill 2238 is a task force bill, so it doesn't have a fiscal attached to it, but because task force bills come to Ways and Means, it would reestablish the Public Safety Task Force, which was the body that has overseen implementation of justice reinvestment. Senator Winters is one of the co-chairs of that task force before it sunset, which it did in January. So it reauthorized that, and then also continue racial and ethnic impact statements. Which is in the current legislation, but would also sunset in January of 2018, so it would remove that sunset. House Bill 2355, the racial profiling, tracking and analysis, the Attorney General's bill, that would task the Criminal Justice Commission with doing the analysis of the stop data and working with DPSST and getting out into the jurisdictions where, if we saw any kind of anomalies, to give them the evidence. And much like you've seen what we've done with justice reinvestment and tracking and transparently displaying, we anticipate doing similar work with stop data. And then finally, the last bill that CJC has mentioned is House Bill 2600, which would transfer oversight of CASA to CJC. So those are just some pieces of legislation that are in front of you, and I didn't know if you'd have any questions, but I thought I'd highlight those.
Any final questions or thoughts? All right. Well, thank you very much. Again, thank you for all of you who made the trip once before or got promoted to the A-team, and appreciate the presentation. On that note, we are adjourned.
Good kind of stuff.
You've got to carry it like this now.
Yeah. See you next week. Yeah.
See you later.
There.
Town hall tonight.
I'm looking forward to it.